particularly with respect to the prosecutions and the whole functioning of these investigations and the process, how did you establish and assure due process? And have you been criticized with respect to due process?
Well, the due process was really kind of spelled out for us in the enabling legislation. The first step is that if a complaint gets filed, there has to be legal sufficiency. So do we even have jurisdiction over the matter? And we get a lot of, we get complaints by prisoners against the state attorney for putting, them away, or complaints against judges. But we have no jurisdiction over these people, so those would get dismissed. Or personnel disputes, where somebody is complaining about, say, sexual harassment or some other form of employment discrimination. So if we lack jurisdiction, we can't hear the case. Secondly, maybe more importantly, there is a probable cause hearing, which is required by ordinance, and that is an adversarial hearing. So the person who's charged with the violation has a right to a probable cause hearing behind closed doors in executive session. So due process is afforded at that level. And if the Ethics Commission doesn't believe there's probable cause, the case is dismissed. After, if probable cause is found, then the person has a right to a full trial or public hearing, once again, where there is due process. And if the person, if there's a finding of guilt, person has a right to appeal that. So I think there are lots of checks and balances that exist on the quasi-judicial side. Even with the advice-giving functions, people have the right to appeal our opinions, and there have been a few of those over the years, not many.
Thank you. Mr. Myers, you talked about the four different functions that your office performs, and obviously when you start, you've got one person, maybe two people. What did you find was the allocation of resources and time? I mean, are you flooded with writing opinions in the first year? Are you adjudicating cases in the first year? Are you doing mostly training? What was your experience?
We did very little adjudicating of cases the first year. For those things that kind of come up to us, bubble up to us, that takes some time. One of the things that we did early on, with the IG, is we looked at some things that people were calling us and telling us that, an example of lobbyists who were lobbying but were not properly registered, and then lobbyists who were registered but they weren't filing their expenditure report. So what we did is we looked at all the people who were registered, and we looked to see if they had actually filed their expenditure reports, and we found like 50% of them hadn't. So we issued a report saying, you got some problems here. So just by doing something like that, letting people know that we're paying attention, issuing a report made a difference. Early on, we conducted seminars and workshops. One of the first workshops we did was the county has an ethical campaign practices ordinance. And we said, well, let's do some training on this. If people are going to be bound by these provisions, they ought to know what it entails. So we did a lot of training the first year, a lot of community outreach the first year, a good amount of advice giving. But once again, it took people a while to know that we existed, but very little prosecution early on. Now, I think our budget is probably 60% enforcement, 20% advice giving, and then 20% outreach and education.
And how many years into it did you start to see that shift over to being more of enforcement and adjudication and less training and advice giving?
Well, once we were able to hire our own advocate, probably 3 years into the process, we needed to find something for this person to do. Because, it was not cost-effective to use these special prosecutors because most of these people were private attorneys, although they gave the Ethics Commission a break because it was, quote, government work. The bills can run up, to substantial sums. So it made sense financially to bring an advocate on board as soon as we could. So we had the advocate, and we had a couple of investigators. So I would say 3 years in, when we had our own advocate, is when things really started to take off.
And recognizing Miami-Dade County is much larger than Palm Beach County,
right,
in terms of population and government, about how many complaints a year do you handle, do you process?
Well, we complaints probably in the range of 50 to 60, investigations around 200, where we'll open up formal investigations of about 200 cases.
Well, when you say, maybe I asked my question wrong. How many complaints come in from the public or other people? Not formal adjudications of complaints,
okay,
but sort
right.
of the beginning of the pipeline, not
yeah.
the back end of the pipeline.
We get hundreds and hundreds of tips. Of those, probably close to 200 wind up being investigations that we open, about 200 a year. And we formal complaints, probably 50 to 60 per year, those that go before the Ethics Commission.
Thank you. That's all I have, Judge. Thank
you. Mr. Farrell?
Explain this executive session probable cause hearing, because I just took a quick look at the ordinance, and unless I missed it, Mr. Berger, there is no executive session provision in this ordinance. That's what we talked about earlier in one of the earlier meetings. Was that in the enabling ordinance for Miami-Dade?
Yes.
And the purpose was to do an investigation without unnecessarily besmirching someone's name.
That's correct. And so if there is a preliminary investigation takes place, if the media finds out about it, I mean, let's say somebody decides to file a complaint and they send a copy of the complaint to the media, because they oftentimes will do that. So I will get a call from someone from the media saying, is it true that so-and-so filed a complaint? I can't comment on that. Well, I have the complaint right in front of me. Well, good for you. So we can't comment on matters that are under investigation. If we're in a meeting, and we handle the opinions, and let's say there are other matters that are public, when the complaints come up, those where probable cause have not been found, we go into executive session, and the public has to leave, and then there is a hearing where the respondent is present, maybe with an attorney, maybe without. Our advocate is present who presents the case, whether he believes there's probable cause or not. The board is present, and then I'm there, and the secretary is there. And at the end of that private session, the Ethics Commission will go back on the record into open session and announce if they've done anything in private. And
is there a court reporter during this executive session?
No, but there's a tape. Okay. So that tape becomes public at the point in time probable cause is either found or probable cause is not found. So everything after that becomes public.
If probable cause is not found, do you still release the tape?
If somebody wants it. Yeah, it's everything. Everything in the file is public at that point in time, including the tape of the discussions the commission had in executive session.
It's modeled after the state.
That's correct.
Right.
Okay. How does your Commission on Ethics work with the IG without... And still maintain some independence, because it sounded like the two offices work closely together.
Yeah, well, at this stage, at one point, I mean, we were, kind of joined at the hip, because the Ethics Commission hired the IG and, in essence, evaluated the performance of the IG every year. But, kind of we went in different directions. But now, it's a mutual... We have this reciprocal relationship where we refer cases back and forth to one another. The IG can and has filed complaints directly with the Ethics Commission. The state attorney and the IG are the two other entities other than our advocate who can file a complaint directly with the Ethics Commission. So if Chris is looking at something and he believes there might be a violation of the county voting conflict section, he could conduct an investigation, although he might just refer to us, but let's say he conducts his investigation. He says, I'm going to file a complaint directly with the Ethics Commission, and that has happened. So we refer things back and forth routinely to one another.
Did you work together on things initially?
We had to, because we had no resources. At this point, we have enough resources where we can kind of do our own thing, but we had no choice, because when we did get the power to hire investigators, we only had two investigators we could hire, so they had to take on ethics investigations and IG-related investigations. It's a very good working relationship. It is critical that you work closely with the other law enforcement and criminal justice agencies in town and even other parts of town. I mean, we routinely refer things to the Florida Bar. Lawyers who are working in government who are engaged in things that may be violations of some of the Florida Bar rules, or the Real Estate Commission, or the Division of Professional Responsibility, whatever that's called, Business and Professional Responsibility. It's just crucial. You have to do that. And I know sometimes people will fight over turf, but we're in a different ball game, because we're not prosecuting anybody criminally. We're kind of an entity unto ourselves, which I think is helpful. So people at least those in law enforcement, don't worry too much about us, because in Miami-Dade County you have a public corruption unit in the state attorney's office. You have a public corruption bureau in the police department. You have an inspector general. You have the U.S. attorney. And you have a bunch of auditors. So a lot of people kind of fight over some of the FDLE. So, like I said, but we're kind of on our own, which is a good thing.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on Mr. Farach's question. If you release the tape after the first preliminary look at it, then why do you need to be in executive session closed?
Well, first of all, it's released only if somebody requests it. But once a determination is made, let's say in the case there's no probable cause found, everything in the file is a public record, including the tape. So if the media requested it or a person requested it, they would have a right, to get a copy of the tape. Once it's public, it's public. And if probable cause is found, the same thing. Anything that was said, in executive session with respect to that particular complaint would be available for public inspection.
Okay. My actual question for you is, can you tell me something about the activities or ways in which you let people know you are open for business?
Well, our website, obviously, is very important. And in this day and age, you can't have, you can't reach the community if you don't have that ability, through websites and other sort of, computer-related activities. We have two people who we call community outreach coordinators, and they're actively involved in the community, and I guess I'm involved too, making presentations, speeches, going to Rotary Clubs, Chambers of Commerce, holding, public, I guess we've held a few town halls and things like that. We provide press releases of our meetings, letting people know the meetings, when they're taking place. We also provide summaries after the meeting, everything that happened. And believe it or not, initially there was some resistance to that because some people felt that, we were going to beat our chest and tell everybody what a great job we're doing. No, we simply go through the things that are public. So if an opinion was issued in a given matter, we summarize that opinion. If a complaint was dismissed, there's a one paragraph on that. So this... I guess it's really a meeting summary more than a press release, goes out to people who are on our list. And, that list keeps growing and growing. It's taken a while, and there are still a lot of people who don't know that we exist. But in a community of 2.5 million people, not everyone's going to know. Going to the professional associations, the bar associations, meetings of, accountants and engineers and, school teachers, just doing a lot of pounding the pavement, speaking to five people or 500 people, whoever wants to hear from us.
Can people file complaints on the web?
Currently, no. They can provide us with information. We have a hotline, too, and I don't think Chris mentioned that, but hotline's really important. And what we've done with our hotline is somebody has that phone at all times. So if you want to talk to a real person, one of our investigators will pick it up. Now, some people don't like doing that, but we found, and I think Chris would agree, that people who leave information generally don't leave enough information for you to be able to conduct an investigation. So if you can talk to this person, it is possible you can draw enough information from them where it might be useful. Most of the hotline calls don't really amount to anything, but some do, and it is a service that we provide and the IG provides, and most governments do that. And I think it's important. It's another way people can reach us, and we advertise the hotline, and we even on the county paychecks, you can put something, some event or some meeting, and we'll put their ethics hotline call, whatever number. So we're constantly out there trying to get the word out that we exist and what it is that we can do. And then another point, if I can, and I think Chris talked about this too, being in a position to refer people, because we get a lot of calls from people where we have no authority you know, to do what they want us to do. They've got a complaint about their real estate agent or about their roofer. You know, they behaved unethically. Well, maybe they did, but we can't help you. But we still feel an obligation, as best we can, to give them a contact information so they can talk to somebody who might be able to help them, because that's part of what I think is public service.
Lastly, could you say something about your relationships with the commissioners?
The county commissioners?
No, the Commission on Ethics commissioners.
Oh, the ethics commissioners. Well, my biggest fear was that I was going to be micromanaged by the Ethics Commission, and I didn't think that I mean, I had no idea whether that was going to happen or not, but I was concerned that I would be micromanaged, and I didn't think that I really wanted a job like that if that's how I was going to be treated by the Ethics Commission. Fortunately, I guess I've gained the confidence of the Ethics Commission, and they've delegated a great deal of responsibility to me. And the overriding concern I have is never to do anything to embarrass the ethics commissioners. When it comes to the complaints, they're the final arbiter, not me. I mean, I don't evaluate the complaints to begin with, but I, for better or for worse, kind of am the spokesperson, so I have to defend, you know, the decisions of the Ethics Commission, whether I agree or disagree with those. And the same thing with the opinions. Those opinions that go before the Ethics Commission, I stand by those opinions. I think it's critical that the executive director has a strong relationship with the chairperson. The chairperson of our Ethics Commission has been given some extra responsibilities. For example, I talked earlier about these requests for opinions that come in, and there's do you take this to the Ethics Commission, or do you handle it as a staff opinion? And, you know, does it matter who's the requester? If it's a county commissioner, does that automatically go to the Ethics Commission? Well, maybe it should, maybe it shouldn't. But what I do, my rule of thumb is I consult with our general counsel, and I consult with the chairperson of the Ethics Commission. And if he says, look, I think this should be heard by the full board, it goes to the full board. If he says, you know what, you guys handle it, then we'll handle it. If there's ever any sort of disagreement between the three of us about what the outcome should be, it will go to the Ethics Commission. So, I mean, I have an excellent relationship with all of the members. I think it's critical. I think that you, as a volunteer board, there's only so much that you can do, only so hands-on you can be, and I think you want to handle the bigger picture stuff. But the executive director needs to be there to support, you know, the work that the Ethics Commission does. I mean, otherwise, that executive director really isn't doing his or her job.
You spend a lot of time with them individually?
With the chairman. One of the problems that we've had over the years, and less so now than maybe 3 or 4 years ago, is just the lack of time the ethics commissioners have to devote to this endeavor. Because the State Commission on Ethics meets, I think, 8 or 9 times a year. I think it's maybe 8 times a year. We try to meet at least once a month. Maybe over the course of 12 months, we'll meet 16, 17 times, 3 or 4 hours. Well, what if there's a public hearing? We now have the authority to use hearing examiners if the Ethics Commission can't be convened. Because think about it, if there's a trial, I mean, you could have literally an all-day hearing. And, you know, people who are lawyers and judges and professors and accountants and every other profession sitting on an ethics commission just don't have time for that. So I try to meet with the ethics commissioners individually. Generally, I wind up meeting more with the chair at least once a month, maybe twice a month. But that's something we have been criticized because we don't move fast enough in certain matters. And part of it is we can't convene the Ethics Commission to meet every week. That's just not going to happen, and it shouldn't happen. We had a county commissioner say that we should be able to turn things around in 48 hours, from the day a complaint is filed. Well, how are you going to investigate it, impanel the Ethics Commission, provide due process of law in 48 hours? It ain't happening. But now, like I say, we do have the authority to use hearing examiners in some of our cases, and that's helped a little bit. But I think it's an age-old problem with any volunteer board, especially one that has the stature of an ethics commission.
Are you comfortable discussing your relationship with the county commission?
Sure.
And how do you find that? Is it? I imagine it's tense at times.
Well, we have filed complaints against county commissioners, and that's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to file a complaint against anybody, especially those who fund you. But you have to do what's right. I try every 6 months to meet individually each of the 13 county commissioners and tell them what we're up to. Or they'll call me, they'll see something in the newspaper, or they'll hear something. And then sometimes they even refer matters to us to investigate. I have what I believe is a professional relationship with each and every one of them. Some of them are more supportive, if you will, of what we do than others. But I think that they recognize that we're fair, that we're really, try to play it right down the middle. There have been accusations, and there are always accusations of this if you work in government, about selective prosecutions and things like that. But we've proven, to people time and time again that that's not the way we operate. We will only go forward with a complaint, for example, if there is something behind it, or we won't issue an audit report unless, if somebody can show that we've done something wrong on that end, where we have conducted a flawed investigation or filed a flawed complaint or issued a flawed audit, then we lose our credibility. And people are waiting for us to do that. And there'll be commissioners that are unhappy about some things that we've done, but they'll talk to me frankly about it. I think the working relationship is as good as it could be under the circumstances, and some commissioners, as I said earlier, are more supportive, and I'm not sure what their agendas are. Some want to advance, the ethics rules in the county. Others may see it as some sort of opportunity for them politically, maybe. Those who have been who have had complaints filed against them, we still they still have to work with us. They recognize that, and like I say, it does get tense and it does get difficult at times. But for the most part, they respect that we exist and they realize that we're necessary and the public demands it. So they usually come around. There was a case, and if I can just one quick story. 1 year when the budget was being considered, the countywide budget, one of the commissioners decided to read into the record a letter, a complaint that had been filed against me and the chairman of the Ethics Commission, the vice chairman, with the Florida Commission on Ethics. And so she's reading this into the record, and the purpose of this was to say we shouldn't fund the Ethics Commission until this complaint is resolved. And another county commissioner said, if we did that, with every department where complaints had ever been filed against any of their people, no agency would ever get funded. And if I can, the complaint was about we had put out a letter telling the community, the business community, that we were interested in doing outreach activities and training for those who do business with the government. And Bell South, they said, we're not interested in the training, but here's a check for, I think it was $2,000 to put into your training program. So I went to the Ethics Commission. I said, what should I do with this check? Should I return it or should I deposit it? And I said, I'll deposit it. I mean, you're using it for training. So